Good morning, everyone. It's Thursday, May 12, 2005. This is a public hearing on House Bill 5077 relating to the 2003-05 budget rebalance for the Department of Human Services. And we'll have a work session scheduled for this afternoon. It's a strictly public hearing, and there'll be some public testimony. I'd like to begin with a few remarks from Mr. Britton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. As the Chair said, House Bill 5077 we are going to be using for the department's rebalance as the department's rebalance bill. It is in its current form a blank bill, meaning it is relating to financial, I'll read it, relating to state financial administration, appropriating money, limiting expenditures, and declaring an emergency. So we use these blank bills for things like the rebalance. The rebalance is a process whereby savings in one particular budgeted cluster, for example, in children, adults, and families, or seniors and people with disabilities, are used to fill holes elsewhere in the budget. So it is a transfer of general fund between clusters, and it can be an increase, or in this particular case, a decrease in other funds and federal funds expenditure limitation. We've had two rebalances before during the current biennium on this particular budget, one in April 2004 and one in November of 2004. During the interim, the emergency board has the authority to make those transfers, and it can increase other funds and federal funds expenditure limitation, but it does not have the authority to decrease limitation, and it cannot disappropriate general fund. During the session for this just about final rebalance, and I'll explain that comment in a second, the legislature, the full legislature, must take action. There is no emergency board, obviously, and must take action through a bill, which is, in this case, House Bill 5077. The department's books will be closed this fall and even into next spring, as I understand it, and they will present kind of a final, not really a rebalance plan, but a final closing the books plan, if you will, in the fall to the emergency board. But this is really the kind of the final shot as far as major action on the 03-05 budget for the Department of Human Services, typically anyway. With that, I would ask Sheila Baker if you have any other comments you want to make.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think the only other comment I would make is that this is the 2003-05 biennium rebalance, so the actions that you take here affect this biennium's budget. There may be, or we expect that there will be, some significant carryover from the issues here into the 0507 reshoot, which you'll deal with later. And in terms of dollar amounts, you can't necessarily look at the dollar amount in the rebalance plan and translate that into some dollar amount for 0507. We're waiting for that pricing from the department. They're working on that. But a number of the issues that you see here, you will see again as revisions to the governor's 0507 budget. And so I just wanted to make that note.
With that, okay. I turn it back to you, Mr. Chair.
All right. We will go ahead and begin, Director Weeks and your associates. During the course of this, we're probably going to entertain some testimony from Dexter at Legislative Council and from Jim Carlson regarding the issue on whether or not all the money that we would expect from the provider tax is going to be forthcoming. But Dexter is not here at this point, so we'll just go ahead and let you direct the course until we get to, we may need to interrupt at that point.
Certainly. Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Gary Weeks, Director of the Department of Human Services, and with me is Vic Todd, who's head of our Finance and Policy Group. As John did a very good job, I think, of introducing the subject today, this is our third rebalance of the biennium. Generally, we do four one roughly every 6 months, but because of the Measure 30 activity and all the special session activity, we actually did only three this time. So this is the closeout rebalance for the biennium. It's typical of most rebalances, and I understand, Mr. Chairman, that the members that are here at this point haven't been through one of these, but we'll walk you through. I just want you to know that it's very similar to rebalances that we generally put forward. There are, I think, really two significant differences in this rebalance. One has to do with the part of the request that asks us for, in effect, a general fund loan to cover expenses for revenues that are not received in the current biennium. That is revenues from provider taxes and tobacco taxes, which don't come in until after June 30th. Any other time during the biennium, we've got cash flow adequate to cover expenses for those revenue that those revenues are intended to meet. At the end of the biennium, this biennium, we're far short of cash. And so we've talked with the Treasury about getting a loan from the Treasury, and in fact have, because we had to borrow in May in order to pay bills and so on. But this request is one that asks you to give us the authority to borrow money from the general fund, and then we will, of course, pay the general fund back when the provider tax revenues and the tobacco tax revenues come into the department. So that's, it's unusual in a rebalance that it happens at the end of the biennium. I think the second thing that's of interest and concern here, and your staff did a good job of reporting on this, is that the department's struggle to try to estimate its other fund revenues. That is to really continue to match both expenditures and revenues. We have for so long been focused on expenditures to stay within the budget and stay within the program levels and so on. But in this particular biennium, I think it's because of the number of special sessions and the Measure 30 and so on, the managing of other fund revenues hasn't been what we would all like it to be. And your staff has suggested a budget note, which we agree with, to really have DAS and DHS, focus in the interim on how we make sure that we're managing the other fund revenue expectations along with the expenditure expectations. So these line up all the time. And I preface my remarks with that because you'll see that as a problem in this rebalance in a couple of different places. So let me just start, and we'll go by cluster. Starting with the children and families page, which should be page two of yours. I've got a little different version, but I'm just going to walk you down through the changes that we're making as a part of this rebalance, asking your support for. And it begins with the TANF program, cash assistance for basic and UN caseload is up. We have about 17,500 people on the TANF basic program. We have about 1,072 on the UN program. The caseload is up 0.7% in the basic program and 0.4% in another. So we're actually pretty close in our caseload forecast, but we've got some increases in caseload which result in the need for us to rebalance there. Employment-related daycare, and I will rely on members to stop me if you want to explore any of these, referred to as ERDC frequently. There are about 9,600, close to 9,700 cases of people receiving employment-related daycare. We think that number is going to be lower by a very small amount, about 4 cases per month. And the cost per case, that is what we're going to pay for daycare, is up slightly, about $1.38 per each case per month. So we have a fairly small adjustment that has to be made in employment-related daycare. On the food stamp program, food stamps, as you all know, are entirely federally funded. The state has to pay for a portion of the administration costs, but the food stamps themselves are totally federally funded. The caseload is up 537 per month, and the costs per case are about $3.79 a month higher. We have over 400,000 people per month who take advantage of food stamps, and that breaks down to about 220,000 cases, but covers 400,000 people roughly. So it's a very significant food program for us in the state. And we've done, I think, in the state an increasingly good job of outreaching to families, those that are eligible, and bringing people into the food stamp program who need this resource. But the number is going up again from the last rebalance.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Wynn.
And I know that we've done outreach and that would drive the numbers up, but what are some of the other factors in Oregon that would have such a high need for food stamps?
Well, Mr. Chairman and Senator Winters, I think much of it has been over the last couple of years the high unemployment rate that we've had. Now, this is improving, and each quarter when you get the numbers from the Employment Department about those working, you can see we're having gradual improvement. But clearly, the unemployment numbers over the last couple of years have driven the need for people to come in and ask for food stamps, as well as other kinds of support from social service agencies.
Is housing, affordable housing, a factor in this also?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Winters, I'm certain that it is, because if people are spending an increasing percentage of their monthly income for housing, that's less money, Senator, that's available for food and medical care, transportation, daycare, all those other things. So clearly housing costs are a part of it, and that varies around the state, of course. So,
Mr. Chair.
Senator Bonas-Henderson.
Do we do any auditing on food stamp abuse?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Moss-Henderson, we have significant auditing on food stamp abuse. We've been in this sort of ironic position as a state in the sense that we have received from the federal government $1.9 million, which we reported to you earlier, in a food stamp bonus for our outreach efforts. In other words, we had done such good outreach that we are one of the best states in the country in terms of outreach. And the converse of that is we have, over the past few years, been one of the worst states in terms of the error rate. And that historically has not been that big a problem, because the error rate, when you had an error rate, the feds calculated what that meant in terms of dollars, and you had to reinvest that back in your programs, which we always did. The federal government changed the rules on that and created a penalty situation. And had we not been able to bring our error rate down, our penalty for the fiscal year that's ending very soon would have been several million dollars. Now, we've worked very hard and made it a high priority to do a better job of calculating benefits accurately. And for the federal government, the error rate is both over-calculation and under-calculation. So if somebody is eligible for more than they receive, that's an error. And so we have now driven that error rate down in the last 9 months to near the national average. And we believe we're going to be able to get out of this without any kind of penalty. But that's all been done by real significant audit program, training of people that are doing the eligibility determinations, and really focusing on making good decisions on eligibility. I mean, we want to have both. We want to have a low error rate and the best possible outreach to families and individuals who need the benefit. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Next item is the refugee assistance. Refugee program is a very small program. It's an entirely federally funded program. We have some increase in the cost there. We're asking for the limitation to expend the federal funds that are going to come in to the state. Emergency assistance for domestic violence cases. We have about 660 cases of emergency domestic violence cases. The number is lower in this rebalance than it was in the last rebalance, and the cost per case is slightly higher. And so you can see the impact on the federal funds. Again, we're talking about federal funds only. So it's a little more costly, but fewer cases coming into the system right now. In terms of the child welfare programs, we look at the foster care system, the adoption system, child safety. All of those things are what we have to rebalance to each time. In foster care, we have 6,200 children in foster care now. That number is increasing slightly, up about 14 cases, which is 0.2%. So we're pretty close to the last estimate you gave, or we gave to you. The adoptions assistance, we provide that to a little over 8,000 families. That is down in terms of what we're spending for adoption assistance, down slightly. And so are down the costs for what we call child safety. Child safety is a whole bundle of services for children and families. It includes mutual foster homes, system of care, contracted family treatment. They're all fairly small, but they're bundled together, and there's something we call child safety. So there's a decline in the cost per case in all of these areas, and that's why you see that we need less money in terms of both the other funds and the federal fund side.
Question on that?
On relative foster care, is there a decline there as well?
In all of our substitute care is down right now, Senator. I don't have it broken out between relative foster care and other foster care. I can get that for you. And I don't know if Jim, do you know?
Could you give me the cost for that, and also
breakout on the relative?
On the relatives, and what's the average? Just recently, I had a member of my community who was complaining very vehemently to me that they had been willing to take some children, and were told that there were no dollars or there were no funds in relative foster care, and this was in a home that much needed to have children removed and placed in a safe environment. The person who was willing to take them worked, and so with our agency saying that the best that they could do was give them $200 a month, they could not take care of a child and her own family on that. So I said I would explore that,
mm-hmm.
And find out what has occurred, because I believe that we did have funds and encouraged relatives where possible to become relative foster parents.
And Senator and Mr. Chairman, that is in fact true. We do try to place children with relatives to the extent possible. And I mean, I'd be surprised if, and I hope we weren't saying that we don't have any money for relative foster care, because we are placing children in relative foster care. I will get the breakout of that for you before your work session this afternoon, and the average cost per relative foster care too, Senator.
Thank you.
Director Weeks, we're dealing with the rebalance here, of course, but the significance of what we're discussing may have an effect on the next biennial budget. And since the biennial budget that has been proposed by DHS was based on the figures that, you know, similar to what the governor's recommended budget was based on, and since the rebalance is based on current figures, and you're saying that in these areas, that just this one little cluster here that we're talking about, there's a reduction of $3.84 million for the final quarter of this biennium, mm-hmm. Can I go ahead and assume then that there's going to be a $64 million deduction for the eight quarters of the next biennium?
Mr. Chairman, no, I don't think you can assume that at all. And that's why there's a difference between the rebalance to try to close out this biennium and the reshoot, which is what we're going to come back to you with to give you what we believe are the most accurate forecasted numbers on cases and cost per case, time in service, and so on. So you can't make the assumption, Mr. Chairman, that you suggested there.
But can I make at least the assumption that there's going to be a trend toward a reduction of cases in the next biennium based on what you found for this final quarter of this biennium?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure you can make that assumption either. I'd like for all of us to have the actual forecasted numbers into the next biennium, because the forecast that we'll talk about in the reshoot is in many ways related to the national budget, you know, what Congress is going to appropriate, who's going to be eligible, and so on like that. That doesn't affect this rebalance. It affects next biennium. So, I'd hope you wouldn't draw conclusions from the rebalance and rather wait till you see the reshoot numbers, and then I think your conclusions and your assumptions are that's where they should be made.
Could you take just a minute and explain so that we'll understand how these projections have been reached?
And the projections for the reshoot or the rebalance?
Well, for the rebalance, because it seems to me that the same criteria that you're using in determining what's going to happen the last quarter of this biennium will also apply to maybe the first quarter, at least, of the next biennium. I mean, I would think that there's going to be a relationship between what you're coming up with for here and what's going to happen in the next biennium.
Mr. Chairman, there is a relationship. We have a forecasting model that we've been using. It's a new forecast model, and I think Mr. Britton talked about that at one of your recent sessions. That new forecast model we're trying to apply to this biennium, and we'll apply it to the next biennium. But the fact that we're saying cost per case in the rebalance, which is a rebalance of this biennium, all the costs that we've had this biennium, cost per case may be down, does not mean that as you reshoot the caseload for the next 2 years, that it's going to be down in that period of time. And so what I'm suggesting to you is I think before drawing conclusions, you should see the reshoot numbers and then the rationale behind those reshoot numbers, which we should be able to give you. For example, how is the federal law or the federal budget going to change the numbers in all of these areas of DHS for the next biennium? That's what we're going to be prepared to tell you in the reshoot numbers, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you.
Let's see. I think I left off on reconciliation of the child support grants. Okay, this relates to, we transferred all the child support activities back in 2003, went through the Attorney General. And so what we have is really a cleanup where we've identified costs that we paid, the DHS paid, out of general fund that we can reimburse ourselves from child support revenues that we brought in that didn't actually get transferred to the AG. So there's a little over $5 million in child support costs that we're in effect reimbursing the general fund for out of the child support revenues. This next area is can be...
Director Weeks?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman.
About to move into community human services, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, before you do that, could you skip over, because Dexter's here and I don't want to tie him up. He's got a lot of things he needs to be working on at LC, and so it wouldn't hurt us to just skip over to page 8, and if we could talk about one aspect of seniors and people with disabilities. If you could go through that, and then
certainly.
I'd like to have Dexter speak on the justification for the conclusions that are reached on the $6.9 million, and then I also would ask for Jim Carlson to give testimony on that as well, and then we'll come back and carry on if that'd be okay.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, at your pleasure. So we'll talk about on page 8 the nursing facility provider taxes. There's a law which is a new law. It's our first time for having nursing provider taxes. It says that the department shall tax or shall collect 6% of the annual gross revenue of nursing facilities. We've been doing that all biennium. Because it's a fairly new program, we didn't collect in the first year, the 03-04 year, all that we should have from the gross revenues of the nursing facilities. And we still have more to collect in the second year, 04-05. And so the $6.9 million is a combination of going back to 03-04 and collecting about $1.3 million in taxes owed on gross revenue for 03-04, and then the balance, $5 million plus, which I think everyone agrees to, is the amount that is to be collected, remaining collected for 04-05. We think the law is very clear. It says the department shall, I may even say the director shall, collect 6% of the gross revenues. We've worked this in some detail with the Attorney General's office, who has made it clear to us that the department has a statutory responsibility to collect these taxes. And that's what this is all about, Mr. Chairman. There's some debate about, I know, and Mr. Carlson can give you his arguments about whether the department has the authority to go back and collect for 03-04. We believe we clearly do. The AG has said we clearly do. And so our intent is to do that, and it's built into to this biennium's or this last rebalance plan. If the legislature instructs us to do something different, we will. But I have to bring this to you because I'm not going to have the department at risk of violating the statute. So that's, I guess, our place on this. And if we don't collect any part of these taxes, whether it's 03, 04, or some portion of 04, 05, it simply means we're out of balance by that amount of money in this rebalance plan. So I'm not...
Okay, well, that's fine. That sets the stage.
Would you like to have us exit? And
if you wouldn't mind, I'd appreciate that. For those that are watching this elsewhere, we have some confusion about whether or not the entire $6.9 million is collectible. As Director Weeks has indicated, during the past year, there's an adjustment made for $5.3 million, and there's no challenge as to the collectibility of that amount. There is a difference of opinion as to whether or not we can go back to the prior year and readjust for that prior year and collect the $1.6 million. And so, Dexter, if you'd come forward, Mr. Carlson, if you'd come forward, what we'd like to do is hear from each of you, and we can get a clarification as to the position of the state and the position of those that would actually be paying for this, so that the committee can have a better understanding. And it helps us it doesn't change whether or not we have to go through the rebalance, but it can affect how much we will have come back to us from provider taxes. Would you explain the legal issue, please, Dexter?
Mr. Chair, members, Dexter Johnson, Legislative Council Office. The legal issue really turns on the meaning of Section 17 of the law that you passed last session. And I'll break that down into basically three components. First of all, the law says that the agency shall collect 6%, amount equal to 6% of gross revenue. So it is not a statement of an amount up to 6% or something like that. It basically, the law commands that a specific amount be collected. Secondly, the law says that the amount shall be collected through an assessment rate that is stated as a dollar amount per patient day. And that's collected in going forward for an assessment period. Therefore, the director, in order to do this, must make an estimate of what the director thinks will be a rate per patient day that will raise 6% of gross revenue. Logically, because that rate is based on an estimate, in order to collect an exact amount, there must be some mechanism for adjusting for inaccuracies in the estimate. And, in fact, the law provides for that. It says in subsection 2 that at the time an annual assessment rate is established, the assessment rate, the director may adjust the assessment rate to take into account overages and underages during previous assessment periods, and that's a plural statement there, previous assessment periods. Finally, the subsection 3 of the law says that the rate is established on or before June 15th, preceding the period, the assessment period to which it applies, the 12-month period to which it applies. So, again, the adjustment for overages and underages is built into this rate that is then projected going forward for a succeeding 12-month period. So basically, because the law refers to previous assessment periods and when you make adjustments for overages and underages, because the law directs that an exact amount, 6% of gross revenue, be ultimately collected, and because the law provides for an annual assessment rate. My conclusion is that the director can collect amounts that were undercollected in any previous assessment period, once that is known, through the process of building that into the rate going forward for a succeeding assessment period.
Okay, so just to summarize, your viewpoint is that in subparagraph 2 of section 17, where it talks about having the authority to collect for previous assessment periods, that the word periods is referring to the 12-month period wording that's in subsection 1?
That is my conclusion, that the assessment period is a 12-month period. The argument here is that the assessments are paid on a quarterly basis, but the rate is established for a 12-month period. I don't think that distinction is crucial, though, because what's significant is, in subsection 2, it refers to previous assessment periods, plural. So even if you make, say, arguably that the assessment period is a quarterly amount, a quarterly period of time, it's still plural, and there's no direction that it says within the same fiscal year or something like that. So there's no limit to a single 12-month period.
Mr. Chair.
Senator West.
Well, it's not here. You keep referring to assessment period as quarterly and then a year. Isn't the payments are required quarterly? The assessment period is a year. Am I hearing you correctly?
Mr. Chair, Senator Westland, that is my conclusion.
And assessment periods, plural, then is what, however many years prior you can assess on more than 1 year.
Mr. Chair, Senator Westland, yes. Assessment period, I believe, is a one-year period, and the law directs adjustments for previous assessment periods, plural, so that means you can go back multiple years.
I'll tell you what, why don't we hear from both of them, and then we can ask questions, because it may get clarified along the way. Mr. Carlson?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jim Carlson, representing Oregon Healthcare Association. I agree with most of what Dexter says. On his last point, though, I'd like to refer to my handout here, which has a number of highlighted sections that goes to the question. Here, Dexter, I apologize, I don't have an extra copy. That goes to the question of what is meant by that definition of assessment periods. And what I would like to say is that you make 13 different references throughout the law to assessment periods. The first one, highlighted there in subsection 4, section 15, patient days, reads calendar period for which an assessment is being reported and paid. Your second reference in section 16 talks about the amount the assessment equals the assessment rate times the number of patient days at the long-term care facility for a calendar quarter, with the assessment period being once again a calendar quarter. Following down to the bottom in section 3, last line on that page, the calendar quarter for which the assessment is being reported as well as being paid. Section 17, this is the real key here, and what I want to do is have you skip ahead back to towards the back of my handout where there's some red highlighted. It's back from the fourth page from the back, if you can find it. And you've got in section 27, subsection 2, you've got a specific reference in this section to an assessment in a calendar quarter as provided in section 17.2 of this 2003 Act. And if you go through and look at all 13 references and read this Act in its entirety, 13 references are made to quarterly assessment periods. So I think, and looking at the fundamental question of what is intended in section 17 sub 2 by the words assessment periods, it's our opinion and the opinion of our legal counsel that assessment periods clearly refers to calendar quarter. The import of that is when you then look at section 3, which gives the state an opportunity each year to account for overages or underages on or before June 15th, that's an important distinction. There's the reason a date was put in subsection 3. And, you know, I'll have to tell you, I feel a little bit here like a guy who attended a meeting, and now we've got the minutes from a meeting, and I've got a lot of folks who weren't at the meeting telling us what was said at the meeting. I was at every single meeting on this legislation last session, and when we looked back on the contemporaneous record of the various drafts here. Section 3 was the last section amended, and original language in the bill had a section that allowed the state to adjust for overages or underages quarterly. Our intent, clearly, was to allow for minor changes to be made in the provider tax rate due to the sensitivity of the taxpayer of being hit with a huge increase all at once. And DHS, at that point in time, and their representatives expressed workload concerns about having to make so many adjustments to the rate and indicated that they were going to need FTEs and the whole nine yards on that. So this language was put in the very last version of the draft, that new subsection 3 language, where it basically allowed for an annual adjustment, where the previous iterations, all previous iterations of the bill, had allowed for adjustments quarterly. And any ambiguity that is in the statute now was created at that point in time. I can tell you clearly what the intent of the legislation was, having been the one who was at every single meeting discussing this legislation, every single meeting we had in regard to it. I think the description of this statute as being crystal clear is probably one Dexter might agree with me. Maybe we're a little less than crystal clear here. I think I've had conversations over the last 3 weeks with probably at least 12 attorneys who have come down on both sides of the interpretation of what assessment periods mean. And respectfully, Mr. Chair, being a member of the legal profession yourself, I'm not trying to impugn the motives of attorneys. I'm just saying that for every attorney who's interpreting this one way, there's another attorney interpreting it another way. Okay. There's some other things that I want to make one mention of. We're focused here on state law. There's a very key federal law issue in play here, which is the federal government does not permit a state to exceed 6% of aggregate gross revenues on their tax collection within a calendar year, 12-month period, whatever that is. The federal law does not say you may collect 8% one year to make up for a 4% collection the previous year. We can use some Enron-style accounting maybe to get there. But I think you've got a fundamental question here as you look at the federal law on, are we taxing future days? Are we taxing past days? Are we taxing future days and allocating costs back to past days? And if you look throughout my testimony here, I've got a number of questions that we raise here in regard to the federal law, which I think must be answered clearly before the state proceeds down this path. I've got one word of caution, and that word is MUPL. And I think we need to make sure we are dotting our I's and crossing our T's very carefully with the feds here, because a number of very knowledgeable attorneys that we've spoken with who work on provider tax legislation have real questions about whether we can collect 8% or more in a calendar year and allocate it back to a previous year.
Okay. We all understand that this is not going to be a tribunal to determine the outcome of this, that this ultimately probably is going to be litigated. And I also understand what you're saying, but I don't think anyone is saying that let's charge 8% this year to compensate for 4%. Let me finish.
Yeah.
For the prior two-year period, but that what we're really doing is trying to assure that the 6% came in for the prior periods. The final outcome of this is going to come down to a legal interpretation, but I thought it was important for us to have this information come out. Are there any questions?
I have a lot of questions, Mr. Chair.
Senator Bates.
Okay. First off, I understand there was a meeting on this issue yesterday that some of the members of the committee were privy to and the rest of us weren't, so I feel like working a little bit in the dark here, and I really don't appreciate that. I've spoken to my co-chair about it already, and I'm not happy about this.
Which meeting is that?
I was told there was a meeting about the rebalance yesterday.
Oh.
Okay. And this particular committee, if nothing comes out of this committee, unless we have a 50-50 vote, and so I'll just drop that from that point, but I'm not happy about it. Because we get into situations like this, we have complex issues, which some of us haven't seen.
You brought this up. The only meeting I'm aware of is the co-chairs and the vice co-chairs, and I attended a meeting. If there's a meeting beyond that, and that was just one for LFO, is there something beyond that that you're referring to?
No, that's what I'm referring to.
Okay, fine.
Okay. And I'll leave it there. So we have a very complex issue here, and many of us aren't very familiar with it or would like to be more familiar with. The provider taxes that were first put together in the last session were put together primarily by the providers coming to us and helping us with a very difficult budget situation. And Jim Carlson's group came forward to help us out. some of the money that was raised in that provider tax didn't even go back to his organization, help the rest of the budget, is my memory, Jim. Is that correct?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Bates, 23% of the $55 million that we're now anticipating coming in this biennium 0305 did go back to the general fund.
I understand that. And so first of all, I'm going to make that point and tell you I appreciate that effort that was made last time. You and your organization drove that through. It was very difficult to do. The federal government does not like these programs necessarily. They have a 6% limit on it, which they watch very carefully, in which they are going to try to cut down to 3% in the near future, if not ending these programs entirely, because it's a way for us to leverage federal dollars into our system. Having said that, I believe that, Jim, you're probably correct in the situation. I'm not a legal authority on this and don't pretend to be. I do not want to see this go to litigation over $1.6 million. This is something that should be resolved inside the House here, I believe. I think that the director is correct in that he has a right to go back over at least 12 months and collect that money. I don't think there's any argument about that. My understanding of this, as I read this, Dexter, is it says the director may adjust rates. It's not a shall, it's a may. So he has an option here if he really wants to go back and do that or not. But it's also contradictory in this first section that says that he shall do a 12-month assessment. And I don't know how you put those two back together when one's a may and one's a shall. I mean, it's ambiguous whether he has to go back under law, because he made the point that he thinks he doesn't want to be in a situation where he's breaking the law but not doing something he's being told to do. To me, that's ambiguous and difficult to understand. But it sounds to me like the best way to approach this is not to get in litigation over $1.6 million. We'll chew up attorney fees in time so fast, you won't believe it. This should be resolved and see if we can do the rebalance without that 1.6. That's just me from 80,000 feet, and I'm no lawyer, Mr. Chair, and I may be wrong about this, but you mentioned this thing being resolved by litigation, and that gives me some pause.
Well, I understand. By the way, this doesn't affect the rebalance. The rebalance is an amount of money that we have to obtain. The money is going to be borrowed. The real question is it going to come back to the general fund or not? And so there's $1.6 million that is in question. And you're right, there are other ways to work it, but I'm just saying that this committee is not going to make the determination, I don't believe, on that issue, unless we pass the bill to do it or something.
Mr. Chair, I would hope on this issue that one, we can do it without litigation, but you're probably correct because of the future implications and impact. And I, as the person who had the task for getting this through, all of these provider tax packages last session, I have to put this on record. It was very, very difficult, and one of the things that we did not want to occur and that we committed is that we would not try, that the agencies, and I had worked with the governor, that we wouldn't come from a 6% and later talk about 8%. We would not get into the issue of trying to increase in order to raise revenue from these entities. Jim's organization, as well as hospitals and others, who came and said we would be willing to do that. It was not easy in this building to pass this bill, nor the bill that did with the hospital tax. And I would hope that individuals who are looking at other revenue sources would keep that integrity in mind, because it was an integrity issue that we said clearly as legislators that if you come and assist us with the long-term care system, Mr. Carlson, and your organization, that we will keep the faith. We will not, in this body, but I think that Senator Bates was there and others. And I would like to keep the integrity of the agreement that we made with these organizations. You can work out the ambiguity in that and those issues, but I think it is an integrity issue. Some of us put a lot on the line to pass this through this body. And everybody was not happy with us coming out with a provider tax package last session. And I have to put that on the table because it's critical when you go out and you ask an organization to please come into this building, tax yourself, and we're going to stick it at this rate. We're not going to ask you to do more than what you did last session. And so I had to put that out there. It is an integrity issue for me. as your chair of this body, who walked that floor and got the votes to get this passed that last session, that both the agency, some of you weren't here when we negotiated this deal, and it was a deal that was negotiated, and I would hope that you keep the faith of the deal as we negotiated last session. And so with that said, I understand that the forward legal ambiguity issue that's there, but I think for right now, I think that the agency, and you sit down and let's see if we can't work out the 1.6. I'm with Senator Bates.
Mr. Chair, if I might, I just would like to respond to Senator Winter's comment to say this is not about the money for me. This is about the integrity of the issue and keeping the deal, keeping the faith.
I imagine for the providers, it may be about the money.
Well,
but
I mean,
certainly for you, it's...
Yeah, Mr. Chair, it's $1.5 million is important. It's a large sum of money, but this is really the principle. This matters, probably what has my members as fired up as anything.
Representative Hansen.
Well, I would think rather than to go into a costly litigation, if there's ambiguity in the agreement, that this committee could introduce legislation to clarify the issue and clarify it. Because I think,
well, certainly we have the ability to do that, especially if it wasn't ambiguous. And I wasn't there, but if it was clear to those that negotiated on behalf of the legislature that there was no intention to go back more than 1 year, then that can be dealt with by us. But there again, that's something that needs to be discussed with the co-chairs and with...
Absolutely. You
know, and get that resolved.
Mm-hmm. It needs to be cleaned up.
Okay, that's fine.
But I think the issue is integrity here.
Okay.
I got to say, I think it's pretty what it's at.
All right, well, that we can deal with as a legislative body. We'll conclude this in just a moment, but Ms. Dexter, if you have any final comments you'd like to make, and then the same thing with Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chair, members, I just want to kind of go over one point that I had previously made, that yes, assessment period, it's ambiguous as to what it means, but nowhere does it say, so even if you assume that assessment period is quarterly, nowhere does it limit it to a single fiscal year.
Mm-hmm.
So I think focusing on is it a quarter, is it a year, is kind of misses the issue a little.
Okay. Legally, you're saying that it is ambiguous enough that the position that DHS and your office so far are taking is justifiable, which is a separate issue than the policy consideration or what took place in after negotiation. Okay, well taken. Thank you.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Jim Carlson again for the record. If I were to take that legal opinion and let's say we'd had this program in place for 20 years, I then guess I could carry that legal opinion back that we could make retroactive adjustments 20 years ago?
Well, there are ultimate statute of repose and other factors that would come involved, but I understand what you're saying.
I mean, to carry that to its...
To that chart that you were showing a minute ago before we terminated.
Yeah, I mean, there are a couple just quick points here that I wanted to make. I think you've got a fundamental question when you look at the state law and the federal law issues here. Are we taxing future days or are we taxing past days? Because that fundamentally goes to some of the issues with the federal law, as well as I think the state law is clear you can only tax future days. So I think that's a fundamental issue. I think the other thing that I think is another important consideration here is under our waiver, we are only allowed to make uniform changes in our provider tax rate. This will potentially, if we're going back taxing future days to recoup money we didn't recover in the past, if I've had facilities that have closed, if I've had facilities that have changed ownership, if I have facilities that are providing more patient days next fiscal year than they did in 2003-04, you start running into providers being advantaged and disadvantaged by that, and you start getting into uniformity issues that could potentially become issues at heart in our waiver that I think needs to be looked at carefully. I think the biggest concern we probably have, going back to our original intent once upon a time of wanting to have quarterly adjustments, the reason we wanted to have quarterly adjustments so we would only have minor changes. What you're looking at right now for a July 1 scheduled provider tax rate increase with the currently scheduled rate and then the rebalance retro rate tacked on top of that is a 67% increase in the provider tax rate, July 1, 05. Now, there's going to be some big sticker shock. There's going to be some big pushback. There's going to be some cost shifting onto the backs of private pay residents if we roll out with a 67% increase in the provider tax rate on July 105. And I think getting back to that issue, the only other issue I want to call into question is on the provider tax worksheets, and I did have that as my third handout, which is has come from the department. The projected bed days that are being used, both going back and for the current year, do not match up with any of the forecasted caseload numbers. And so I am not sure which set of numbers, you know, ultimately we're using at the end of this when we get to the reshoot, but there's a lot of different nursing facility numbers floating around. This biennium, old forecast, new forecast, provider tax worksheet numbers, and none of them match up.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, I have a question. I want to know, though, if this provider tax has helped the industry. I mean, it obviously has brought in more money for the industry, mm-hmm. which helps the industry. So I don't want to I need to hear from you. Mm-hmm. You don't want to scratch this. This is just about this one issue. Is that what I'm...
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Bonas Anderson, we remain committed to the program. I mean, I've certainly got some members who've been kicking me and expressing misgivings about what we got ourselves into when we lay a 67% tax rate increase on the table. But by the same token, yeah, if we'd have blown a $40 or $50 million general fund hole in this program area last biennium when we were in the pit of our budget crisis, we wouldn't have come out of that intact. We would not have survived. We have made many positive strides forward. I think Mr. Taves, in his testimony last week, told the subcommittee we went from being one of the lowest reimbursed Medicaid nursing home rate states in the country to getting up into the mid-range now. We've done made tremendous progress on wage and benefit levels for caregivers, which have dramatically reduced turnover rates. If you look at your CNA training reimbursement that comes back on the federal funds in this rebalance, you've seen that the state didn't spend as much on CNA training. The reason for that is turnover rates have been down this past year, which is a significant accomplishment in this workforce. Also, I'm very pleased to report that you are seeing a number of significant remodels and upgrades of old, outdated physical plants in a number of facilities throughout the state, even two new facilities is being constructed to replace old, outdated physical plants, which will improve not only the quality of life for the residents who receive services there, but the quality of the workplace for the workers who work there. So, yes, this has helped us make a number of dramatic improvements in a very short period of time, and we remain committed to the program, but I do think that I've got trust issues.
Mr. Chair.
And the winners.
Just follow along the good senators. As I understand it, not all of the facilities benefit that you have. Some facilities who pay the tax but do not benefit from. Is that not correct?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, that is correct. We have, and under federal law, so that you cannot have a hold harmless in place, you must have winners and losers in this. Facilities that serve only private pay residents or only private pay Medicare VA or have a very high percentage of those patient days versus Medicaid do lose. They lose big. They pay big taxes. Our former board chair, who was chair of our board at the time this legislation was passed, operated a all-private facility. This particular piece of legislation cost his facility over $250,000 after it was implemented. That's the individual who performs my annual review at the time. He readily admitted he took one for the team on that because it was good for the industry, it was good for the sector, and it was the best solution available. Would we have preferred to have had general funds? Yes. Would we prefer to have general funds next biennium? Yes. Is that likely to occur? No.
Okay, enough on prior text. Thank you so much for coming
Thank
in
you.
And ventilating this issue. And, we are now all up to speed on it. Director Weeks. Committee, we're back to page 3, Community Human Services. We have 1 hour left in this public hearing, so I'd like you to kind of guide us through, make sure that we get through the...
Mr. Chairman, we will do our best to...
Thank you. today. Let's make that a half hour.
Okay. We can do that, Mr. Chairman.
I know that. I wouldn't say if I didn't. Okay. We just don't have to dwell on minutia. We can kind
yes.
of...
Yes. Yes, I'm going to try to feed through and highlight the important things. Okay. I left off on page 3, Community Human Services. I don't think there's much to say on this. This is if you haven't been involved in the rebalance before, this can be confusing. Community Human Services was, when you initially adopted this budget, it was sort of a separate cluster. It was all the field operation. We've now brought the field back in to the policy and program because it just didn't work that way. And so we always report to you because we have to. That's the way the budget is structured about Community Human Services. And basically what we're saying here is that there are staffing needs. If we use the staffing formulas that you approved, we would be coming to you for staffing. We aren't doing it this time. We didn't do it in November. Haven't ever done that. So it's just a point that we've given your LFO staff so they know where things are. There's some budget corrections that have to do with fees that we collect, the marriage license fee, and criminal fines and assessments and trust receipts. Those fees, other fund fees, when the reorganization happened in this agency and the budget went to you in 03, those were double counted. And this just takes that double counting away and corrects it. These are fees that support 34 different community-based domestic violence operations. Seniors and people with disabilities. We have some caseload increases, modest caseload increases in nursing facilities. The caseload is a little over 5,000. That caseload is up modestly. We have caseload decreases, however, in what we call the licensed community facilities, which are the residential care facilities, assisted living facilities, specialized facilities. There are some decreases going on in those facilities. So you've got slight increase in nursing homes, decreases that are fairly small in licensed care facilities. I'm not sure much what more you want. We're just balancing those caseloads out as we always do in a rebalance. You can see that there are two other items, which are the hourly home care worker caseload. It's down. It's reduced by about 390 cases. And the live-in, pardon me, Mr. Chairman, which are the 24-hour live-in caseload for home care workers, those cases are increased by 35 cases. So you've got people coming into homes working on an hourly basis as home care workers. Those caseloads are down a little bit. 24-hour caseloads where people are in the home all the time, up slightly. There are revenues that we take in from Social Security, SSI recoveries, and nursing home facilities. They're slightly lower than what we had estimated in November. It's a little bit uncertain why those are down, but the reality is that we are taking in less SSI revenue, which we have to compensate for. There are funds that we receive from the clients in the client employee provider program. Those revenues are actually a little bit down as well. And I think that's primarily because we overestimated what we thought clients would pay as a part of the client employee provider program. There is money that we spend for developmentally disabled folks, and our estimates for both adults and children are increased by about 55 cases. It's slightly over $1 million in general fund additional costs. So this is a pretty small program and a fairly small increase. We're asking you, we came to the September e-board in September of 04 and asked for authority to get a grant, a federal grant, called the Real Choices System Grant, which integrates long-term care support and affordable housing. We got the grant. This rebalance asks you for the authority to go ahead and spend the grant. So we received what you gave us approval to apply for, and the rebalance is our way to ask for approval to accept the money and spend it. There's some administrative things on here. The FUTA tax, federal unemployment tax. We reported on this in November as well. Some of you on the e-board will remember that. The department pays this FUTA tax on behalf of home care workers. We pay both the federal unemployment tax and we pay a state unemployment tax. Now, it's still puzzling to me that we have to pay both these, but we have been notified by IRS that under the law we have to pay the FUTA and what's called the SUTA, the state unemployment tax. So we had to make one more adjustment of a little under $1 million to take care of that. There is, we initially proposed, and we've been working on this for several weeks now, but we initially proposed to you that we add 12 positions to help us with presumptive Medicaid determinations. Subsequent to that, and since we're only about a month and a half away from the end of this biennium, we're going to withdraw that, and we've worked with Mr. Britton on that. His recommendation indicates that we've asked to withdraw that. We'll manage this for the balance of the biennium, and it can be a discussion, Mr. Chairman, as a part of the reshoot for whether we actually need these positions in the next biennium. General assistance program. The general assistance program is very small now. I think, as you know, it's been scaled back considerably. The caseload is smaller even than what we expected it to be, so we have a reduction in the general fund requirement for the caseload, and that's a savings of about $2.8 million. With regard to developmentally disabled programs, we settle up with the counties at the end of a biennium where we've paid out money that they actually didn't use for either program costs or administration costs. So this next item reflects the fact that we've as a result of those settlements, we've brought in about $4 million in unused program money, and then there are about another $1.6 million that we're bringing in savings that the counties had in special projects and local administration and so on. So it's just a kind of a truing up of what we give out to the counties. If it's not spent, we recover it. So it comes back here as a $5.6 million general fund savings, a recovery that way. OSIP, Oregon Supplemental Income Program. This is a program that aids the blind, disabled, special needs folks. It involves home-delivered meal services. There are 47, nearly 48,000 people who benefit by this. We have a slight increase in cases, about 600 cases. So the additional cost to continue this population is $1.5 million. So out of 47,000, nearly 48,000, it's a fairly small adjustment that we're making. Nursing home provider taxes. Would you like more discussion about this? And,
I think we're
happy to continue that. So. I'm assuming at some point, maybe later this afternoon, you'll give us a direction on how you want this managed. And
well, Mr. Chair,
Senator Westlake,
just a clarification. Heard discussion from the dais and the witness stand. $1.5 million issue, and here we have 6.9.
Mm-hmm.
That just that. Round numbers.
Mr. Chairman, Senator,
$5.5 million of it is
correct. I think
$1.5 million is okay.
That's my understanding. And so what's at question here is 0304, and all I would like from you is in terms of clarification is the department's obligation, because I can't shop for a legal opinion. My legal opinion comes from the AG, and the AG has been very clear in writing that the department, it's not about the right to collect this. It's about the department has an obligation to collect this money. And if you want to direct us differently than that, then I'd like to make sure it's very clear, Mr. Chairman.
There's no question with that. There's lots of times we pass laws that ultimately get interpreted in a way that's contrary to what the intent is.
Mm-hmm.
We can't control that. This is an issue where the legislature can help determine the outcome, mm-hmm. so that you and the DOJ are not going to be in a situation where you have to just base it on what is within the actual writing of the legislation. That's what a court's going to do. They're going to say, this is what the word says, and if the word's clear, we're going to enforce the word. If there's a lack of clarity, then they'll go back to legislative intent. Well, to avoid that, we have the ability and the time to take actions.
And that we would welcome that, Mr. Chairman. I just
co-chairs will make that ultimate decision with input from those that were there.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I'm certain of that.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Moving right along, the next item gets into what I started the conversation about, which is one of the two unusual parts of this whole request, and that is the department's need to have an advance from the general fund in order to cover our costs for the rest of this biennium, while revenue comes in after the biennium for tobacco tax and provider taxes. The amount here, the 12.96, is what's needed under this particular program here, the seniors and people with disability cluster. And then there's another amount that we'll get to that's needed under the health cluster. So the total that we're asking for to be advanced to us and use as revenue is $77,770,000, I think. And I've already signed a note for this myself. Yes. Now, I'm not worried. You know, I'm not too worried because I'll be dead before they collect it. And But we just so you know, we've received a portion of this already, Mr. Chairman. We received $32 million. We've had what's the total? $45 million in May in order to pay our bills and everything. So we've already gotten a portion of this, and there's some interest charges on this as well. So I think it's something that we run into, particularly since we have these new provider tax. We've never done this before, and I don't think ever imagined that we were going to have the problem of not enough cash to the extent that we do at this stage of the biennium. So,
okay, I'll have a comment on that when we get through the whole the remainder of the
all right,
items. So we're going to health services.
Yeah. I help.
I have a question.
Senator Winters.
I want to know where the debt instrument is. Is it the Treasurer's Office, or where is the borrowing from?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Winters, yeah, we borrow from the Treasury. The Treasurer has the authority to loan money to agencies like this, and the loan it has to be against real revenue, Senator, and so this loan is against the revenue that's scheduled to come in on provider taxes and tobacco taxes.
Then can you tell me what's the usury rate?
Well, I don't know if it's usury. I think that would be unfair for me to say that the Treasurer has a usury rate. The interest rate is 4%. It's about 4%.
It's not exactly a mate rate.
This isn't a payday loan, is it? I mean
no. I hope not, Senator. Office of Medical Assistance Programs, we have an adjustment in OMAP, and this is the PLUS program. We have about 418,000 enrollees, just to update you. That's total enrollees in OMAP's program in the OHP Plus. We have a caseload forecast that's just a little bit under 1% that we're trying to balance out here. And that caseload increase comes from two ways. One is the non-cash TANF. So these are folks that are just getting health care coverage, and that number is increasing. And old age assistance populations. That's where the increase comes in these two categories. And there are about 1,650 new cases on the TANF non-cash and about 530 in the old age assistance program. Tobacco tax estimates by the Department of Revenue continue to be lower than what we expected. There was a big drop in November, you remember, when we did the last rebalance. We had a significant reduction in what we had expected in tobacco taxes. Those continue to be lower than expected by about $2.78 million. And then the next item is the other part. It's the other part of what would need to be the loan. It's the remaining tobacco tax and provider tax revenue that is expended, excuse me, in the health cluster. So that's about $64.8 million. So if you add that to what we just discussed in SPD, $12.96 million, you get the total amount that we need advanced, and that is the $777.77 million.
Committee, this is a point I'd like to just make to us. You know, we're talking about $64.8 million here and $12.96 million. It's $77.8 million that, for the most part, is required because we have budgeted on a cash basis, but the revenue comes in on an accrual basis, essentially.
Yes.
That's right.
And so that is an ongoing problem. And so we have a $77 million hole this time, and at the end of the next biennium, we're going to be here facing the same issue because of the same circumstance. And from a budgeting standpoint, and I'm not speaking for anyone other than myself, but I just want it on the record that I believe that it's inappropriate for us to pay interest and borrow money if we can somehow come up with the money to pay the debt in the period when the expenditures are incurred. And so rather than do this every quarter, I mean every final quarter of every biennium, I would hope that this body will watch for opportunities when we might have some extra resources to pay this debt rather than continue to borrow and pay back and have to pay interest, which will only increase as rates go back up. Senator Bates.
Mr. Chair, thank you for your comments. I'd like to point out two things here. One is this is a $77 million debt, which is big bucks, against a $9 billion budget.
Correct.
And it's a fraction of 1% of your entire budget, so you've actually managed to balance a huge budget here at the end of the biennium. But unfortunately, because of the reasons you just pointed out, we've got a problem. I would expect that that might occur during the biennium, too, at various times, when you might be in a situation where your revenue is lagging behind your expenses, but ultimately it levels out. It's kind of a chronic problem when you have a budget this big to make that final little piece work for you. It might be wise, if it's all possible to, and if it's legal, to hold back a little bit of money so you have a little bit wider edge there, so you don't have to come face this committee every time you need extra revenue. You've had to come to the emergency board several times. My memory is revenues were okay, your rebalance have been good. I think what's really important is what I'd be much more concerned about if you're coming to us and saying, gosh, this is what our revenue stream is, this is what our expenses are, they don't match, we don't need a loan, we need money to finish out the biennium, and we will not be paying it back. I'd be much more concerned with that. So I congratulate you for at least balancing the budget. It's a tough deal when it's a $9 billion budget. But the problem that the chair is speaking to is one that maybe internally you can look at as some way of resolving the future.
Senator Webster's.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question about this. The good senator brought up another interesting point. How much do you have in reserve? Or do you have a reserve?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Winters, no, we don't have a reserve. And Senator Bates is right. This happens throughout the biennium because revenues never line up, particularly on tax revenues, whether it's tobacco tax or provided, and they never line up with the expenditures. And so throughout the biennium, because we do have a $12 billion budget, we've got cash, and we can be fronting cash and moving things back and forth. It's when we get to the end that it all catches up to us. And we haven't seen this really to this extent, Senator Bates, before, because we didn't have the provider tax before. This is the first biennium we've had the provider tax, and I suppose we could have looked ahead or should have looked ahead and said, gosh, you know, when June 30th comes, we weren't going to have the taxes still for much of the last quarter, but we didn't, and so we wind up in this case. And I think the budget has been managed. I have to say to you, after doing this for 7 years, I have yet to come to you with one general purpose e-fund request. We have balanced this budget for all the 7 years I've been here without asking you. Now, we've used your dedicated e-fund where you have a dedicated purpose and we come and get it, but we've not used a general fund purpose. And that's, you know, there's a lot of credit that I think goes to people that have tried to manage this budget within the department. So, and I wish we didn't have to ask you for this loan now.
I have a question on the reversion. Okay, we're talking about money is supposed to come back to us afterward.
Yes, sir.
With the possible exception of $1.6 million that we've discussed, can we as a body count on all of this money coming back to us from the provider tax and tobacco tax? Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, that's a really good question, which we've worked over and over ourselves because we want to be sure that we can pay the loan. We had to be sure we could pay the Treasury loan back, and we believe that the tax revenues that yet to be paid and the tobacco tax yet to be transferred to us are adequate to pay this.
Can you think of any other fluctuations that could lessen the reversion that we need to keep in mind?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I can imagine that if a bunch of nursing homes went broke and didn't pay the taxes that we're expecting in the last quarter, that would have an impact on this.
Failure to pay the expected revenue. How about anything from within DHS?
I'm sorry?
Anything with any variables within DHS that might affect the payback of this reversion?
Mr. Chairman, I can't imagine it because really the paybacks from those two purposes, the tobacco tax, and of course it's running less than what revenue told us it was going to be all throughout this biennium. Now, we think we've been conservative on estimating what they're still going to pay us for the rest of this biennium. And as I said, the only thing I can imagine on the nursing home side is that there's some catastrophic losses to nursing homes, which means they're not going to pay their taxes. But there aren't actions that we're going to take that affect the collection of those two taxes.
All right. Mr. Benton.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm not going to speak for the department, but I would note that in their letter, I'm trying to find it, it's on page 3, there is some discussion about caseload forecasting and the fact that inherent in most forecasts is the possibility of error, in fact, the high probability of error. And I think there is some discussion in here about the fact that there's a lag between the time the forecast is made and the data that's used. And I think that is an issue that is internal to DHS, perhaps somewhat beyond their control, but nonetheless, it could affect the reversion if the actual caseload and costs of the programs came in higher than are currently in the current forecast. If that were the case, the department could revert all the money, if you will, but they would probably need an emergency fund amount this fall, probably in November, to meet their expenses. By the same token, if their caseload forecasts are too high, they might be able to revert more general fund. So that's what we're up against here.
Well, let me, Mr. Chairman, if I can just add one other thing there. We are trying to hedge our bet on this as well because of the uncertainty of the numbers. And that, and we're doing that by, you know, we're not filling positions that we can hold off for another month and a half. You know, we've told the entire agency we're going to try to, we haven't put a freeze on anything, but we are not going to begin to hire people that we could defer on until the start of the new biennium. We are deferring on all major purchases for the next month. Well, actually, this has been in place for a couple of months now, too. IT purchases, all of that we're deferring on. And we're trying to create some cushion for us, our own reserve, in case we're a little off on the numbers over the next month and a half. So,
Mr. Chair.
Senator Westland.
I just kind of want to put some of this in perspective, and I don't want to diminish the need for accurate forecasting and getting this absolutely as close as we possibly can. We make policy decisions based on your numbers, and I mean, this is important. But just in terms of the overall issue here in the $77 million, I mean, that's 0.08 of a percent of their overall budget. And you talk about the issues we deal with and they deal with. I mean, trying to predict human behavior and plug that into the conditions that affect this budget. I mean, everything from the weather to interest rates to the economy to meth to price of gasoline. I mean, everything that goes in, you know, to influencing this budget. 0.08% ain't too bad. I'm not alleviating any responsibility for you guys to get us absolutely the gnat's eyelash numbers. But overall, boy, I'd like my companies to be able to do that.
President Hanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, it's inherent with different types of taxing systems that you have this problem. Local governments have dealt with it for 150 years in terms of property taxes. They're due the 1st of November, and somehow you have to create a cash flow to get you through the years, and then create tax anticipation notes, and there's lots of different types of vehicles and stuff that can be used. But it's just the nature of, if you've got multiple taxing schemes or proposals out there, that some of them have different characteristics, and this is one of the characteristics of this particular tax, is there's always going to be a need to anticipate some money at the end of some budget years.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Moss-Anderson.
Yeah, thank you. And this isn't unique to DHS. I mean, when you take a look at least on the school boards where I was very heavily involved in the budget process there in from my area, we were borrowing. We got payments, yet we had to borrow, and then we would get a payment, and then we'd start getting interest because we had more money. And so I think this is something that we shouldn't be harping too much longer on.
I raised the question, thank you, Mr. Chair. I raised the question about borrowing because of the constitutional issue, and I wanted to be assured that it was coming from the Treasurer's office, because unlike your school boards, it's not the same. But I also want to add, and I'm pleased to hear on the tobacco tax issue, because that's when we had allocated some resources to the Department of Revenue for them to become a lot more aggressive on this issue, and they have not realized the results that they had proposed to us. So it's something that they said that they could do, increase the amount of dollars, and that did not materialize, and as a result, that's why you have that. And of course, my question to Revenue is if they still have those staff positions, and whether or not they're being a lot more conservative about those numbers than they were in the past.
Good. Mm-hmm. Committee, we need to reconvene at 3:30, and so if we could finish this up at 3:30, and then we'll have a work session immediately following that. The 3:30 reconvening will be in Hearing Room D, and so without objection, we will recess until 3:30 today.
We haven't got to vote for it.
Yeah, quick question. Will this $77 million add to the 12.39 budget cap, so we've got now another $77 million that we can spend?
Let's see. That was 0507. This is 0305. Guess not. Without objection, Richard.
I want to get into that.